The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Michael Brooks is the host of The Michael Brooks Show, the co-host of The Majority Report, and a future author for Zero Books. This week, he returns to the Zero Books podcast to discuss Jordan Peterson and the left-wing union, James Hillman. It's Thursday, July 19th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to thank everyone for supporting the Zero Books podcast on Patreon. We just passed our goal of reaching 400 patrons. Patreon supporters get access to the Inside Zero Books podcast, Symptomatic Redness, and the Alternatives podcast. Counting Zero Squared, Patreon supporters get access to two podcasts every week and are helping us continue to produce our YouTube channel and our other online projects like our Capital Reading Group. The music you're listening to right now is the theme to Rebel Without a Cause. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Brooks and I discuss the Jungian Circle of Life.
Do you think that Jordan Peterson's star is waning, or is he just getting started?
Well, I think in terms of how the media landscape works now, I look at those things a bit differently than maybe I used to even a year or so ago. And I think it's kind of like, is his star waning in the sense that, is this guy going to be, you know, a constant presence? Is he going to get New York Times profiles written of him all the time? Is he going to always be on TV? Is he going to always be sort of setting a certain conversation, have books on the bestseller list? I don't know about that. I think in that sense, sure, it will cool down a bit and there's some life cycle to these things. But I think that he's established a real beachhead for himself and he's a part of culture and the conversation. Now, you know, maybe in a decade, it'll be, oh, that was a little odd or embarrassing. Or maybe in a decade, he'll be, he'll be even more entrenched and successful and compared to whatever the next, you know, proto-fascist wave is, he'll look moderate and grandfatherly.
Right.
But I think for now, he is of and in the mix. And I think that's sort of how I look at some of these guys. I think that you can have a dent, you can, lose some of your luster, but if you have a following, you're in the culture in a certain way. And I think in some ways, I mean, that sort of reflects today's media environment. There's fewer and fewer. There's almost no universal superstars anymore, right? I mean, there used to be these kind of mass platform, mass personalities, even as recently as like Jon Stewart in The Daily Show or something everybody watches and reads. And now I think, you know, is Ezra Klein the wunderkind that he was in, like, I don't know, 2010 or something? No, he's certainly not. He's not as sort of central to the beat of the culture, but nobody is in a certain way. And he's certainly beachhead established. And I think Jordan Peterson is definitely at that point. We shouldn't kid ourselves about it.
Right. He's one of the last big mass media celebrities, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And that he's, and even if that goes away to some extent, I mean, the following is there. The the ground game is there, as it were. So, you know, is it going to be like, oh my God, who is this guy who's crying and, you know, causing all this ruckus and we really need to figure him out? And I mean, obviously that's already dying down, but his basic imprint in culture, I don't think is going anywhere.
Yeah, I think you're right. You recently brought up to me that there's another Jungian, he's deceased now, but another Jungian who was on the scene in the 90s and who might be a nice antidote to the kind of Jungian psychological neo-reactionary politics that Jordan Peterson is pushing today. And that would be this guy, James Hillman. And I was aware of him. I actually remembered his name. I read one of his books or attempted to read one of his books. It was kind of a dense academic book about, dream interpretation, that I tried to tackle in the 90s when I was in my 20s. You're fascinated with him now for a variety of reasons. One is which that you're more into the kind of, spiritual side of things than I am. So you find him appealing for that reason, but also because he's, an antidote to Jordan Peterson. Am I characterizing that right?
No, I think in some ways, yeah, I think you are. James Hillman, although my sort of more woo-woo side, I guess, ironically enough, is probably, I look at it and interpret things differently, which of course is no surprise, but I think Sam Harris and I actually share a Vipassana meditation teacher, which is sort of funny, and ironic. So I kind of come at these things less from, I'm not very well versed in Jungian ideas. And I've always had a bit of an allergy to them. I guess I found them. I mean, I guess I encountered them in a kind of basic way when I, watched the Joseph Campbell, Bill Moyers series, which I probably watched, you know, like in college. But Hillman was this very, very interesting figure. And he was very grounded. I mean, I believe he actually directed the Jung Institute in Zurich. He generated his own school called Archetypal Psychology. And he is a real intellect, and a real, thinker, regardless of what one sort of thinks of the, you know, philosophical orientation he's coming from. And I had, heard of him, probably again in that sort of college kind of phase several years ago. You know, probably, like in, I don't know, maybe I first heard of him like 2005 or so when I was, you know, more on like the meditation circuit and reading books like that. But I already had a strong interest in politics, and I do recall that Hillman, would occasionally sort of lean into politics a bit. I wasn't very well versed in him, but I did recall that. So recently I sort of took him back up again, just because it strikes me. I don't think that the fact that people are interested in mythology or storytelling or narrative structure, or even how those you know, maps and stories could potentially influence their lives positively. I don't have an innate allergy to that, the way some people might. So the reaction I have to Jordan Peterson, I mean, frankly, I do actually find his sort of presentation of that material pretty bubblegum and kind of, you know, sort of linear in a way that I am skeptical of, believe it or not. But I don't think that the big crisis of Jordan Peterson is that he's telling people that maybe they can find, you know, interpretive maps of meaning in sacred texts, as an example, doesn't freak me out. You know, the politics freaks me out. Now, maybe we could have a debate about whether or not those two things can be separated or not. And maybe that's another conversation, but.
Well. Yeah, that's what I want to actually, this is the kind of the conversation I want to have around James Hillman, because if it's true that Hillman's politics, and I just watched like a YouTube interview with him, yesterday to kind of get ready to talk to you. It's my new lazy way of approaching, research. Yeah, but if his politics, which I would kind of characterize as being on the Chomsky radical side of American politics, although it's I don't want to denigrate Chomsky by saying that. I mean, Chomsky has a very thoroughgoing anarchist syndicalist perspective, and I wouldn't say Hillman does, but I would imagine that Hillman might have picked up Z Magazine at some point, you know, that kind of thing. Hillman's, if it's true that that kind of politics can follow from Hillman's union perspective on the world, then we can cleanly separate Peterson's union ideas in something like a Maps of Meaning or a self-authoring program from his political perspective. If we find that James Hillman's being inconsistent, then, you know, if his politics don't really follow from the union assumptions, then we haven't really arrived at a conclusion, but we might be willing to say that Jordan Peterson's union psychology is at least possibly the reason why he's so, I hate to say reactionary because it's such a loaded term, but I think it's accurate in his case. So I'm going to just go ahead and say reactionary.
Partially, you can, and you can by appealing to some arguments that certainly a rationalist would find really unsettling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think Hillman is one, and I think maybe he does track, by the way, with Peterson in this way. I don't think he is not a literalist about this, but I think he's one of the world is animated. Objects have a meaning and purpose outside of just their sort of material constituents, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Dreams matter. There is a forms of a collective experience. Now, there's a whole other theory he has of an acorn theory of life, which is a sort of argument against behavioral determinism. Now, for purposes of this conversation, though, what that leads to and where his intervention is very interesting, and I think in his case it would be it would be too easy on someone like me who might have to, if I think he's worthwhile, take on some of his arguments, which are, you know, people are going to find more controversial or shaky or questionable. And it would be unfair to him because he was, I mean, not only was he a Jungian, I mean, again, he directed the Jung Institute in Zurich. I mean, this very highly respected person in that world. His argument, though, when it came to a book that he co-authored and he called We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World is Getting Worse, was really this very sort of simple, or I mean, not simple. He basically said, look, you are, by decoupling people's individual atomized lives from larger social problems, therapy isn't addressing what the real crises in the world are. And he had some very concrete examples flipping that. He said, you know, he said, maybe you walk by a homeless person on your way to work. And, you know, you go to the therapist, and I forget the specific way he gamed it out, but the therapist will give you some sort of story about your dad or something as to why you were unsettled by the homelessness. Now, Hillman is, you're unsettled by seeing a homeless person because it's a reflection of the inequities and abuses of our society. And the appropriate reaction is that you're upset about it. And it should instigate you to a form of action. It's what's also interesting is he actually also had this really harsh critique, and I guess this was much more trendy back then, of this sort of inner child discourse, that people needed to find and care for their inner child. This is, I'm just going to quote briefly from an interview, an excerpt in the Sun magazine from the 90s, which was an excerpt from this book. that I'm talking about, 100 years of therapy, and the world is still getting worse. And it says, Kilman scolded therapists and psychoanalysts for dwelling on such things as a patient's inner child when they should be focusing on the real world with its social ills and injustice. And he sort of, so as I say, though, it isn't a purely material response to the injustices of the world. There's a Chomskyite position. There's a Z Magazine position. There's probably, if I have to, as I say, I'm still digging into this, there's probably appeals to things like, I would imagine he might be receptive. I'm not sure, but he might be receptive to something like deep ecology. He might be really, interested in, you know, other sort of means and discourses for knowing and participating in the world. But I think that the core intervention that there is a use of these maps and meaning, and by the way, a use that's much more unsettling than essentially just a, you know, that's the other kind of funny joke about, you know, the funny thing about Peterson. We were doing a riff on this on my show recently, and it was sort of like, the other thing that's hilarious about Peterson, and I forget who was making this point, but it's like, you know, you go through all of the, you know, the pyramids and the Bible story and the Gilgamesh and all of this out there stuff. And the conclusion is like, you should show up to work early. Right. And Hillman is, well, the conclusion is that your life, you know, your job might be really terrible, and you should leave it. Or you might need to get on the streets, or you might need to, you know, whatever the case may be, you know your neighbors, whatever. But even those things that sound simple are a lot more unsettling and confrontational and externalizing. He's really saying that therapy lost the boat by internalizing and coping and trying to adjust to a dysfunctional society versus seeing what its role is in changing a dysfunctional society. And that is a fundamentally different baseline and obviously a much more positive one.
Yeah, and I'm not educated enough about Jung to know to what extent Jung's own take on psychology was similar to Hillman's in that regard. In other words, did Jung think of the role of the therapist in terms of helping the patient construct, say, an ego identity that would function in the world as it was? Or was he a little bit more like Lacan, what I know of Lacan, where the aim was to free the patient, not necessarily to make the patient fit.
Right.
And I mean, I kind of tend to think that Lacan and Jung are in opposition to each other around that question, but
I am very much a holder of the position that, well, certainly things like Jungian psychology or religion writ large, you know, are hackable and changeable phenomena. So I, you know, if, and I guess certainly in this case, as somebody who is a very serious student of Jung, if James Hillman can work from that tradition and articulate these arguments, then to me, it sort of becomes self-evident. Like, you know, you go to Islam or there's all this heat and fire around, and you know, some of the baseline arguments which are important, it's like, no, you really shouldn't. I mean, I think now, unless you're really deluded, maybe you're seeing as a practical matter why you shouldn't be discriminatory towards Muslims for all sorts of legal, political, and civic reasons. But even at the more deeper level, like, you know, the anti-Muslim bigot position is conspiratorial and wrong, and, you know, absolutely misses the boat because, oh, you know, all the true Islam is brutal fundamentalism or even terrorism. But conversely, I mean, the whole, like, well, that isn't true Islam kind of Lada argument does. I mean, the reality is that there's, you know, there's Islamic socialists, there's Islamic Sufis, there's Islamic plutocrats, and there's ISIS, and they're all Muslims. Because I'm a believer, you know, if you claim a tradition, I basically take your word for it. And they all have interpretive nodes inside their tradition where they can basically build a narrative and a structure that supports everything from, you know, like a capitalism to beheading to social welfare to, you know, basically like, you know, to Oprah, but Islam style. And I just think that's how most cultural phenomenon works.
Yeah.
That it's not necessarily preset, if that makes
sense. Is there a distinction here between a religion or a cultural stance? Because you could even take the religious aspect of Islam out and think of someone as a culturally Islamic, right? I mean, they don't have to even believe in God to be part of Islam at a certain level. If they say they're part of the tradition, they are, kind of thing. But is there a difference between religion and psychology? Because the claims of Jung or Freud or Skinner or any of these psychologists is not that they are providing a blueprint for a way of life that can be modified based on different circumstances and that people can pick up and alter as they will. But their claim is they have a model that explains human consciousness. And that's a different claim. And if you're a Jungian, you have this model of human consciousness, it might lead you to certain kinds of conclusions about the world, regardless of whether you're living in New York City or in Syria. Or you see what I'm saying? It's like
although paradoxically, I mean, maybe to me, Jungian theory as I've encountered it, which again is not that in depth, and I have no comment and judgment on the, you know, I actually would assume and probably be pretty confident that this type of model might be really effective on a sort of psychotherapeutic and practical level. But I think that, you know, I think B.F. Skinner and behaviorism obviously has been discredited and very problematized in a lot of ways. But generally speaking, I think that if you were working, say, take it to 2018 in a neurocognitive tradition, there might be, and there should actually be a lot of critiques of maybe the philosophical underpinnings of something like cognitive psychotherapy as an example. But I do think that in this conversation, I don't know if it's, I don't want to say religion, but I think that maybe Jungian psychology might be more analogous to, you know, a body of thought and way of approaching the world that for better and for worse, and I do mean that, I don't think religion's the right word, but I think it is, it's probably not a philosophical system that can be judged in the same way as ones that are more, you know, objectified and data-driven systems. I mean, as I say, I still think there's all sorts of room for, there's always the story behind the data that we have to get to. But at the same time, you know, if somebody's working in a model where they're saying like, you know, we're interested in the right, whether it's nutritional or drug treatments for something like anxiety. Now you could have all sorts of questions, like how are you going to deal with anxiety in such a specific way? Or, you know, you're giving somebody a drug, but maybe they're anxious because they're in a seriously anxiety producing situation, right? That's actually the Hillman critique, which is, I am inclined to agree with. But that being said, you know, you can kind of test, like, is this theory about the way a neuron fires, you know, how does that look under the microscope? And I don't know if Jungian theory really, you know, I don't know if it really lends itself to that. You know, I think it's much more, you know, much more in a literary, interpretive, philosophic tradition which I, again, I don't say in any way as criticism. I'm just trying to be real about the, you know, so that's why I would feel more comfortable saying, putting Jung in the Islam example than something like, you know, I don't know, behavioral psychological method, because behavioral psychological yeah. method, you can say like, well, does that work? Did the person quit smoking or not?
So here's my, I'm just going to shift from that argument to a different point.
The absolute greatest enemy of Hegel is this, sometimes even some Hegelians fall for it, this, let me call it, circle, to refer to the greatest movie, blah, blah, Lion King. You remember the disgusting song, Where I Become a Goebbels Guy, Drop My Gun When I Hear It, The Circle of Life. You know when? And who sings it? The lion on the top, of course, says to his son, you know, through we are eating zebras, but zebras are eating, but we then turn to dust, to manure, manure feeds grass, and zebras are eating grass, and we are eating zebras, and so it's a cycle of life, no? This would be for me the truth of The Lion King, to replace this song with a different song. Imagine that at the end of the film that I don't like, of course, Life is Beautiful, let's say that the son sees through the horror of Auschwitz and turns to father, to Roberto Benigni, Dad, but it's horrible. The Nazis are killing us. And then in a Monty Python style, Roberto Benigni starts to sing, but my son, it's all part of the cycle of life. It's true. Nazis are killing us. But then Nazis will drop dead. Their bodies will be manure to cows. From cows, they will make steaks. And we, with our Jewish money, will buy the steaks and eat them. So it's all one big cycle of life, no? But the point is precisely that how to make a cycle of life where Nazis don't kill the Jews, no? In other words, this entire model of fighting the extreme and finding the balance is false. Is false.
I find that there's something that Jordan Peterson and James Hillman have in common, which is this assumption that by studying the archetypal structures in the mind, we can discover a spiritual truth that can guide us as to what our way of life should be, and how we should behave in the world. Now what, and maybe even what the best kind of society, would look like. And that both of them rail against the kind of Cartesian rational approach to the world for having lost touch with the archetypal, the spiritual, the traditional, and for, and so they're both critics of modernity in that way. And that to me is troubling because I worry about how it might be very easy to go from liking James Hillman to liking Jordan Peterson just along that axis. It's just like, okay, he, you know, Hillman's right. But rather than embracing multiculturalism and, Eastern traditions and, spirituality from native peoples and those traditions, I'm just going to embrace, my own traditions. You know, the European traditions more and rail against rational redistributionist policies in, you know, in government and, embrace hierarchies, which are traditional and so on and so forth. I mean,
so you're saying that you think that any version of, so unless you're totally rooted in the rationalist tradition, then you're sort of innately susceptible to reactionary politics?
That's a very strong way of putting it. I would say it like this. Unless you are embracing the Enlightenment project of working on freedom through reason, you are susceptible to reactionary politics, which is not the same thing as saying entirely through and through 100% rational, you know, like Spock or something. Like you, because I think reason itself has unreason built into it. I'm like this Hegelian, you know, this is my, I'm wiping my nose right now. It's my Zizekian side. It's like you can't escape irrationality. But you need to, even in the face of irrationality, even with the limitations that reason has, commit to reason and rationality as being superior to dogmatic traditional ways of life. That leaving yourself in a position where you're radically free and open has to be, also an embrace of reason.
Yeah, I think there's a pre and a post here. And it gets tricky. I mean, you know, Ken Wilber, who's another one of these guys who, I mean, I'm much more familiar with him than Hillman, and I have, you know, I mean, he's got a lot of problems. His presentation of science is flawed. He actually is pretty Hegelian in a, you know, spirit evolving through history sense, which I actually really don't find. I mean, I am, particularly when it comes to kind of historical sort of progression, I do look at it in a highly materialistic and specifically Marxist way. So, you know, stipulating those critiques. But one thing that he had an intervention, which is funny because it was sort of like aimed at the new age in the 80s, where he said there's post-rational and there's pre-rational. And pre-rational is the regression, right? Pre-rational is, well, I'm tired of all this rational stuff. So whatever isn't pre-rational is, you know, is good, basically. And so that means, you know, emotion over reason, any expression. I mean, you saw this, I guess, you know, the caricature from the culture he was writing it for would be like, you know, from the 60s through like the 90s, but, you know, the new age, right? Like, we got to sit in a hot tub and scream at each other. And we got to privilege, you know, you always privilege spontaneity over intellect and all of this. And his thought was that, yeah, that again, that a lot of these expressions are just, you know, it's just pre-rational. Or an example would be, you know, the easy example would be, literally believing religious mythology. That is, you know, it's just not true, right? We know that the earth wasn't created in 7 days and it isn't flat. And that isn't like a contested, it's not like an ontological question. It's a literal, you know, that's a very objectified, question. To that extent, we know it isn't flat and it's not 7,000 years old. There's other things, obviously, that we don't know in terms of, you know, how the Big Bang actually worked and stuff like that. But that actually would be an example on the flip side, actually. Post-rational might be, you know, the potential higher complexity that could come out of questions of cosmology as an example, which I won't venture into because I don't know. But you see what I'm saying is that somebody might, propose, you know, out of physics, an incredibly unsettling worldview, which seems to counter all of our, both experiences as we live it day to day and also, rationalist assumptions about how the world operates. And there might be a theory of how things came into being that actually would seem to totally contradict those things. You know, not from a religious perspective, but from a right, exactly. So, and then he would also suggest, and, you know, he did some you know, this is a much more narrow claim, but like, we know, as an example, if you go back into these older arguments about, you know, what is happening when people engage in practices like meditation, and some of the old, rationalist arguments against it would actually be like, oh, well, sure, maybe it's shifting consciousness, but this could be, you know, it could just as easy, it could be shifting it to madness or irrationality as an example, right? But now we know that, well, no, actually, from the sort of basic and rudimentary, but credible science, to the extent things like these MRI scans and stuff out of the University of Wisconsin and Richie Davidson is real. I mean, you know, it's progressing. Well, you know, you can say certain things like, no, actually meditation generally lowers stress in the body. Some other suggests that it actually, you know, increases empathy, and things like that. So I guess what I'm saying is that when I look at Kilman and I look at Peterson, I'm looking at Kilman as saying there's obviously a lot of things that flow out of this, you know, the dark side, if you want to call it, of this rationalist tradition, right? I mean, it's not like as if the Enlightenment project, as it has been funneled, just the, you know, scientific and market advancement, it's not as if that hasn't caused major catastrophes. I think a perspective that it might have its own flaws, but for better or for worse, is saying this is a way of being that negates a lot of other values and way of being in the world. And so we need to, you know, challenge it from that perspective. And obviously that does go into, you know, I mean, that goes back to Heidegger, that goes into interest in, you know, pre-industrialized societies, whether they're in Africa or Latin America. I guess my position is it's very tricky terrain, but it's not something you can innately dismiss. I think Jordan Peterson is basically just, as I say, I think the trick is it's really just get back to the 50s with some Jung, or actually keep accelerating capitalism, but go back to the 50s culturally with just some sort of groovy stories wrapped around it. I think somebody like Hellman, whether they're succeeding or failing, is trying to reorient society. And that already makes it a very different project. If you're putting, you know, corporations on the table, you're telling people to read Marx, and that already puts it in a very different terrain.
Life could be a dream if I could take you up in paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love, life could be.
I feel as though Peterson, I don't know if he really is arguing for people to go back to the 50s. I think in some ways he definitely is. He's definitely arguing for, the nuclear family as being central, for an acceptance of patriarchal authority, which we've lost. And for him, you know, we've lost it. And for us on the left, we've gotten rid of it. But I also think that the deeper level with him is that he's reacting to problems that if he had been alive in the 50s, he would have found even then. You know,
right.
It's not as though the traditional way of life has been, first of all, the traditional way of life is not the nuclear family, right? It's agricultural and extended families.
Right, right.
And so he would have found lots of things to rail against, if you think deeply, there are lots of things to rail against just in like, you know, in the American suburbs and the alienation and spiritual emptiness of that life.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
I think he's a a reactive character. He's like really reacting and being kicked around a lot by the times he's in.
Right. And I think that again, I just think that's such the starting point of Hillman is the suburbs are making you miserable. The starting point of Peterson is get yourself in order before you worry about the suburbs.
Right. Right. Absolutely. That is the difference. That is a big difference. But the reason why Peterson says get yourself in order before you worry about the suburbs is because I think deep down he thinks the suburbs have so destroyed our individual psyches that at this point, before we can even begin to address them, we have to try to rebuild ourselves. We're so messed up now and alienated now that we have to start on ourselves before we can start on the world. But maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
I think that might be giving him too much credit because I think also I think if that was really the case, that that was his position, as flawed as that position is, then he really would not have a political bias of any sort. He wouldn't have, because on that level of you're just spraying your psychological damage and immaturity into the world through politics, which is the charge he always levels at the left.
Right.
Then that would apply to essentially every single iteration of politics, particularly in our modern environment.
Yes, it absolutely would. That's almost my position half the time, like on a bad day. That's what I definitely feel like. Oh my God. Everyone just needs to shut up. But no, I mean, obviously, that's not right. It's a respectable position to take, especially if you've been on Twitter for any length of time. It's like everyone is awful.
I would still think you're drawing a false equivalency, but that would be a position that would both, and also wouldn't be a position from which one could build such a giddy rabid following from.
No.
And I think that, you know, he really, I mean, when he goes on Bill Maher and is like, essentially saying, and you know what, he's saying to something like, you're gonna hurt Trump voters' feelings, or, well, you know, they don't like it when you criticize Trump like this, or if you remove Trump from office. Well, I mean, if the stance was, I'm always reminded, and I don't know, did you ever watch The Sopranos?
You know, that's one of the ones I missed. It's one of the, you know, the best TV or whatever, the golden age of TV shows I missed.
Great show, and everything everybody said about how good it was, I think is probably true.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something which is a slight spoiler, and I would hope that everybody listening, and you has the character armor and psychological maturity to deal with it.
Okay.
Say, there's a scene in, I think, the second or third season. One of the storylines is, you know, is Tony's wife, particularly, you know, the show is actually really a very, it probably could have been written by James Hillman, actually, in terms of it's a ruthless critique of a lot of psychotherapy. Essentially, psychotherapy is just sort of an appendage to, you know, helping suburban psychopaths be more effective capitalists. And Tony's wife, particularly earlier in the show, she's kind of constantly, you know, she's on a spiritual and psychological mission. And of course and she feels and claims to feel all this guilt about essentially, you know, she gets to live the McMansion, suburban, affluent lifestyle. And she knows that her husband's a gangster and he kills people and he hurts people. And you know, it's, fairly, I mean, it's, you know, it's a good show, so it's more psychologically complex than this, but it's like, she, like pretty much everybody else in the show, it's like, she doesn't actually want to grow or risk anything. She just wants to process some of her guilt. Because, you know, And she goes, and finally, like, you know, she's got a priest that she deals with. She got, you know, all of these people, and the priest, all this, not, you know, pray for your husband, all, you know, all this bullshit. And finally she gets to this, like, real tough old Jew. And she's kind of like dancing in between the lines, like, you know, my husband's a good person, but blah, 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 blah. And finally he goes, oh, he's in the mafia? And no one else has said it, right? No one else has said it this directly. And she starts crying. And he basically is like, oh, well, you got to divorce him immediately and get your kids away from him. That's it. There's nothing else that can be done. And she said, well, you know, the priest said blah, blah, blah. And he could be a changed man. And he goes, well, maybe if he spends 20 years in prison and reads Dostoevsky, maybe he'll have a moral awakening, but not right now. Like, and he's like, and by the way, I'm not going to take your payment for this session because I don't take blood money. And he goes, and then he riff where he's like, he said modern therapy is about, you know, something the effect of like coddling people's narcissism. And he even makes a joke about something like, you know, this was when it was before it was so culturally saturated, but he's like, go to any, watch any, you know, reality TV show or go to any ethnic pride parade. And you know what I'm saying? And to me, that archetype and the whole point of the series in many ways is basically just that the old Jewish therapist is right. And he's calling everything correctly. And to me though, like, that is a position that has no indulgence for any bullshit. I think it's a false equivalency, but Jordan Peterson would be a scold of, you know, the babies who, the Republican, you know, everything, and a sort of advocate of broader psychological maturity. And funnily enough, I mean, I read a book, another one that I might revisit now, but it was called The Sibling Society by a guy named Robert Bly, who I think was a poet, and he collaborated with Hillman and sort of did some, that a kind of new age version of this kind of, you know, men rediscovering masculinity stuff. Although as I recall, he was actually also a big, you know, he was anti-war activist, anti-military industrial complex. And he wrote a book called The Sibling Society. And if I recall, it was written in the '90s, and is basically just like, you know, Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich are children and they're fucking, you know, and so it's like, okay, so there, you know, there is a lane for that position, but then you'd actually have to really not pick a side in the culture war and coddle one side. And he does.
Right. Yes, he does. Yeah. That is the thing that really is disturbing to me in a way, because, well, let me see if I can. It's not disturbing more than other things. I mean, lots of things are really disturbing. Like what's going on in the border is really disturbing. This isn't disturbing like that, but one thing that troubles me is how universal this, what people call like, the liberal pathology, or people think of this as like, you know, the social justice warrior mentality is just rampant everywhere. It has nothing to do with your political perspective, most of the time. And the worst people for this are people who are like Trump supporters and on the right. They're just absolutely terrible when it comes to taking offense and thinking that they have some, you know, right to their opinions and that you can't question it, or else you're attacking them. And Peterson's fans are really bad about this too. And cause I made these videos about Peterson, that are critical, but which really don't go after him as a, you know, as a person that much. Yeah. I mean, I do a little bit because I go after him because he ducked me.
You embody those, like, you know, all of these cliches that these people have totally ruined. You actually do. Like, I was on a really brief tangent. I mean, I do genuinely have, I'm a little bit more on the Hillman side of things in some ways. But that being said, I do think it's actually culturally catastrophic that things that we all should actually value open inquiry, you know, free exchange of ideas. I mean, it's just been so utterly destroyed because it only ever is used by disingenuous reactionaries.
Yeah, it's awful. It's terrible. But they don't mean, I mean, they don't mean it. And the people who are their fans really don't care about it is what I've discovered in my, you know, admittedly anecdotal sample of Peterson fans. But it is what people mean when they say, I'm for free speech is really, I want you to accept my perspective and you should not criticize me. It's, that's what the right means when they talk about free speech often enough. And it's of course the opposite of free speech. That being said, I did listen to Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson debate for like 2.5 hours, last night. And, you know, I had to take some breaks just based on tone and the earnestness was so severe that, you know, I had to like watch a Seinfeld's, you know, comedians in cars for a minute just to like clear my head.
I've never been a huge Seinfeld fan, but I've actually really been enjoying that. I loved the Bill Burr and Dave Chappelle one. But
yeah, those are both great. Yeah, those are both great. Yeah. The show is people think it's about, you know, that it's bougie and about nothing, and it is bougie and it's about nothing, but it's legitimately relaxing to watch these people just sort of enjoy.
It's relaxing and funny, and it's funny. I've dissed Seinfeld a lot, but it's actually, I'm like, oh, I kind of get it now. The Obama one, I don't know if you saw that one, that was actually. That line at the end where Obama's like, I usually do these things to plug Obamacare, but I realize like it's about nothing or something. And he goes, I know you don't like to talk about issues, Jerry. And Jerry's kind of like, yeah. And Obama's like, I won't want to solely your show, but talking about how people who don't have health care get health care. That cracked me. I was like, wow.
Yeah, he was good. That was like that. Watching him on that show made me feel like, oh, yeah. Obama was, I mean, he was cool. We really lost something.
Well, culture matters in the presidency. That's the thing that I disagree with a certain type of, you know, for those signifying liberals, it's all culture and it doesn't, you know, banks and drones don't matter because of comedians and cars with coffee. But I think for people on the left, they're really sometimes really negate that it's like, it's also absolutely a cultural position. And having a guy model like intelligence and compassion and sophistication, it actually mattered that he did that. And it was a positive influence on culture. And, you know, and my God, what a fucking downgrade.
Yeah, I agree. But going back to the debate between Harris and Peterson is that if you can wade through 2.5 hours with these guys when they are with each other, there was a debate going on that was rather complex and was open, but the audience was responding like it was a football game, cheering for their side. And caring more about the little rhetorical points that were made rather than the substance of it. I think that's how it read to me. And what it definitely felt stalled out. Listening to them, there was a repetition of what they were debating about on different levels, but there was no third perspective. Basically, the problem was I wasn't there. I could have like set them straight, like within the first 10 minutes. Because they kept repeating like this question of whether it was tradition or rationality that mattered. And I would have come in and said, look, you can't only consider these things on the level of how people think. You also have to talk about how people live. And so what you're doing is trying to set up a culture where people are free enough to be able to be rational, that, you know, that kind of thing. And I would have.
Well, that's where they all miss. I mean, that whole, you know, dark web world, it has nothing to do with practices. I mean, even down to the level that they don't, at least from these anecdotes of like, you know, dealing with the fans when you criticize one of their heroes, down to It's funny you say that. I mean, I have a friend, a good friend who, and it's led to, I mean, we've had real unpleasant conversations. He just, you know, for whatever reason, he's able to hear some criticism, but he's, you know, I'm mystified. He really likes Sam Harris in some ways, but he did say, you know, he saw Harris at some forum and he was like, you know, he's like, he said there's some college kids there that were just like, he said it was like, he goes, why aren't they, you know, he's like, you know, he's a sports guy. So he's like, well, why don't you actually go watch a good fight at a sports game? Then try to get all revved up about, you know, some guy in a blazer being an atheist. Like, that really isn't the point. But that's how they're
right. Yeah, exactly. It's the sports fan mentality around these guys. Like, I'm gonna watch this guy destroy this other guy's arguments. Oh, no, that's not how this is supposed to go.
And that goes to, and it's funny because to me that genre is so specific to the kind of YouTube compilation culture, and it has very and a lot of it owes to Christopher Hitchens, who, you know, was first of all, at least it actually made sense because he was a wit and he was a polemicist and he was a great debater. And it is actually really funny because these people are constantly whining about ad hominems and all this stuff, but they're sort of satguru, if I could use an Eastern phrase, with a master. I mean, you know, Chris Rich is one of the greatest ad hominem insult artists I've ever read or seen in my life. And good for him. I mean, that's why I have a big soft spot for him. And also was, you know, and also was much more, I think, willing to, I think he actually did take on all comers, and was able to, I mean, I've seen Chris Richards debated everybody from Al Sharpton to Robert Wright. You know, it was not just, you know, in terms of, you know, people that opposed him and, you know, from, you know, very different sort of ways of doing things and perspectives. So these guys are constantly going on about those things. And yet, first of all, they have a very contradictory relationship to polemics and ad homs. And then they seem to be only kind of debating each other. And the reason I say this is because it shows that even in the specific areas that they're always banging on about, they're not committed to practices that reflect them. You know, and that's Sam Harris. I mean, you know, we said it's so much more interested in what people think than what they do. Now, maybe if I was to be more, you know, he would suggest that obviously people's thinking is the basis of what they do. But we actually kind of know from a lot of different sources, you know, including our own lives. I mean, we all get in cars. I think that global warming is a, you know, mass catastrophe that's already happening. I still practice being in a car.
Right. I think that it's terrible that children are forced to work in sweatshops to make t-shirts and socks and, but I still buy cheap socks at Bymark that I don't, precisely. And I don't look at where they were made. You know, I just don't
precisely.
Look.
Precisely. But you know, and you think and you understand that it's a moral calumny that those children are, and anybody is treated that way. And I know that my phone is not only assembled in a sweatshop, my phone is also fueling, some of the most intensive conflicts in the world. In places like the Congo, because that's where the minerals come from that make these things. I know that. And I'm still, you know, working on everything on my phone. And that's where the action is, not in the thought process.
Paradoxically, to get beyond it, we're going to have to think up things to do that can replace or at first just stop and then replace, the kinds of practices that we have now.
Without thinking is very important. I'm just saying that it isn't that, and thinking is a practice. And I actually do think consciousness matters and intellect and of course, but I think if you are so, I mean, first of all, at the smaller level, you're not enacting that which you preach constantly about. And then on a second order, if you're always sort of looking, I mean, because what's sort of funny is that in a way it converges, because with Sam Harris, it's all, you know, everything's just your, or so much is reduced to intentions and thoughts. So you don't have to engage in the messiness of actually dealing with these things. And then, you know, in Peterson's case, it's all, well, you know, like, why don't you brush your teeth before you worry about the Congo? You know,
I always love the Peterson impersonations. I don't know why. They're just, oh God.